What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the DeQuisto Series podcast. We got a little different of an episode for you today. We're not going to focus on a specific topic. We're going to take some time out to hit a few different listener questions. We're going to talk about gear. We're going to talk about postseason scouting, the Mobile Hunter Roadshow, and focus on some of the more frequent listener questions that we get.
There you have it. That is
really getting jacked up.
We're going to start out by talking about the Mobile Hunter Roadshow. We've been getting a lot of questions. If we're doing it again, where will we be? What are the dates? And just want to update everybody. Yes, we do have a circuit plan for 2022. The states are as follows: Iowa, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Ohio, and Alabama. The dates of these shows will be released in the next week or so. They'll start in May and go on through August. Sign up will be available. You can go to www.mobilehunterroadshow.com. There you'll be able to see all the information once we launch the official page and guest speakers, daily plans, what we're scheming, and you'll be able to see all that there. Okay, so diving into some of these listener questions, being that we sell stands, sticks, bags, you know, we're pretty gear extensive, we're going to dive into a couple specific gear questions. So one of the main questions is, do we use different gear for different hunts? What this is referring to is use cases, weights, benefits, downsizing, maybe grabbing a different model of stand versus sticks. And so essentially what I sum up from the question is, are we actively changing the gear that we use based on situation or terrain?
How many models do you own?
Yeah.
Just about every one we have. I started out early with the 0.5 this year. Because of the bow holder being moved off the platform now, it made it a huntable stand for me, where the first year I was just too crowded, spent 99% of the time in a 1.0. But I didn't see a lot of, you know, I could see there's, some guys say there's not a lot of room on there. But every tree that I picked was just a tiny bit leaning back and gave me about 2 extra inches on that end, and it,
you know,
I wasn't starved for space.
That's a game changer with the bow holder, because, you know, if you're a guy who's wanting to minimize the screw-in bow holders and you were looking to use that in-platform bow holder, it did, I will admit, it significantly made that stand smaller, you know. So the addition of that bow holder on the outside, it frees up everything. So yeah, if you're a guy who's got a 0.5 and you're kind of, you know, thinking it's a little too small for you and you're using the in-platform bow holder, you get you one of those sidekicks and, I mean, you're pretty much smooth sailing. So you would think, you would say that you used the 0.5 more this year?
Early, I used it quite a bit, but I'd still say majority of the
half
year.
Half and half?
Yeah, a little bit more 1.0, but then when it got to actually late and I had a field test, I used that 2.0 a few times. So really comfortable, ton of room. Man, if I ever had to sit all day, that'd probably be the one I'd be in.
Yeah, you know, I thinking about this question, I think there's a lot of variables here. Are you on, you know, private ground? Are you packing in a long ways? I mean, these type of things I think will change that. You know, whether it's a more of a permanent set, like you said, that 2.0, if you're going to be parked in that thing for a long time, that extra platform room, you know, might help you out.
Yeah, you're not going to hike a mile backward on your back, though. You're just probably going to use something smaller.
So was there specific instances, like what made you go with the 1.0 versus the 0.5?
So if I'm going to dive in and get in, especially in the morning, and have to set up, stick the whole ball of wax in there, I'm using less sticks and using that smaller stand. Literally, I went in a couple times with one stick, and to set a stand up in the morning is literally nothing. It's a matter of a couple minutes and you're up and in and hunting. 1.0, again, if I'm, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours on post, that extra room, a little bit heavier. But I'm not hunting public where I'm driving in all the way in, walking all the way in or walking all the way back. So a lot of times I'll go preset my morning spots, even with the portable. I'll drop that 1.0 in there, and then I'll come in the morning and I'll have everything pretty much preset. Sometimes you'll even have my camera arm in there and bow left behind. So personal preference. I mean, I use it. There's a place for them all, basically.
Yeah, I think until you've hung a 0.5, even though you're talking about a, you know, you can argue a measly 3 pound difference, until you've hung one of those things versus a 1.0 or versus a heavier, like an old, like an alpha stand or
it's 4 pounds is a lot of weight.
Well, it's like, especially, you know, with an outstretched arm or you're wrapping that thing around the tree, but it's so nimble and lightweight to set up.
And when you get in it, you're closer to the trees. You feel a lot more, comfortable up there. You're not way out, you know.
It keeps you nice and tight. A lot of people don't realize too, the meat of that stand is closer to the tree than on your 1.0. Yeah,
big difference.
So you have that standing room.
What are we going to do with a 0.75 now?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Do you see yourself going to the middle? I mean, like you just said, you're a guy who's half and half, and we'll get to what I do pretty quickly, but that might be like your, is that going to be the perfect blend for you?
I think for a lot of guys, it'll be the one model that they can run with. But I see a ton of guys running with them both already too. 0.5s, 1.0s.
Just so, changing up.
Yeah. And again, we're field testing stuff too, or I am anyhow. So I literally have to hunt with every different stick we have, every different stand we have. I would love nothing better to settle into one and just run it. 1.0 is done. I mean, that thing is dialed in, sticks, the integration of everything in there with the hooks and things in there. I think that thing is just a machine.
Prime example, that's where we kind of, you know, we might differ a little bit, but like I'm so vested in that 0.5 that it actually, you know, for the purpose of field testing was why I switched over. I had a lot of people seeing me running the doubles this year, which I've always been an advocate of single step.
Yep.
And I'm like Mr. Anti-Double, and I've gotten so many messages of people like, what the heck? Like, wait, you changed to the doubles? Like, I bought the singles because you like the singles. And, you know, and I switched up, you know, to test out some of those different, like, stud options, you know, maybe get a little bit better grip on those hard trees. So it started as a field testing process, but I really kind of fell into a groove with them and like them a lot. But as far as stand goes, like, I just do not need anything more than the 0.5. Like, you know, I could probably,
I don't know if you could make it a whole season the way you run it in and out every time with that 1.0. It's just a lot more stand, you know, to be dealing with on a daily basis.
And,
so.
And that's where, like, so I look at this question and I know guys who will switch up their gear. I've always been wacky in my head with whether it's my vehicle or like the stand setup or my backpack, like my everyday carry backpack. Like I'm just like completely OCD. And in my mind, I need to possess the stand, the backpack, the vehicle that is a do-all. There cannot be multiple things. And you know, I might be, you know, just in my mind, it's unsettling to me knowing that I have different options. And I don't know if that makes sense, but like, I believe now my setup, which is the 0.5, it's two doubles with a custom like 23 inch aider that we might, you know, be doing here, a little longer one, but two doubles, those aiders, the larger seat on the 0.5, like that's my specific kind of blend. And I'm so efficient, so quick. I can pack it up, unpack it, and virtually hang it in anything. I just like feel warm and fuzzy knowing that there's never going to be a situation me going through the woods that I can't hunt versus, right, you know, going in with a big one. And then like, oh, then you see, you know, let's say you're going with the 2.0 with all the anticipation to sit all day or whatever, or you want more platform room, and the spot that you need to be in is this tiny little cedar tree that you need to, like, right, you know, jam in. So So I don't do much changing with my stand and stick setup. I think, you know, to dive into why I chose.
Oh, the less weight. I mean, it's like nothing on your back, you know.
Yeah. And I think when you're looking at doubles versus singles, there's not much of a weight difference there, really. I mean,
the big thing I think a lot of guys with doubles, they don't have to think about which way they're going up. You go up any way you want, come down any way you want. That's the big advantage, I think. Now, they do, and the reason why those were never developed early, we had climbers for trees that a lot of guys now use hang-ons on. The trees we used years ago for hang-ons were so many branches in there. Even your single compacts, sometimes you don't even use a step on it because there's no room to even get them in. Where that could be a little challenge if you get in a real brushy cedar tree with the double steps, you're starting to fish for a spot to get them in. But I will say, and you know how challenging some sets, sometimes you'll spend 10 minutes positioning a stand. Having both feet on both steps is a dream. I mean, you're literally like you're on the ground setting up your stand. So,
yeah, coming into switching over from the, and that was one of my biggest things about advocating for the singles is all the gnarly hedge trees and the cedar trees and all those tight spots and just small little trees that I was wanting that flip available with the step or sometimes not even putting that down. And, you know, and then I'm,
them doubles are sweet on little trees, though, aren't they?
And that's the thing now, you know, so not going out and now, so I switched over, 5 days into season, ended up, you know, running them for a couple weeks and then killed, out of state and then just ran them the entire rest of the season. And now, throughout this course of the season, I mean, I couldn't tell you how many trees I hung those in, big, small, hard, soft. I mean, they performed like super well, even on little thing, even on those ones I was worried about. And you know, one of the driving factors for that was being I only run two sticks.
You run a belt system too, right?
The original belt. Yep. So
1-inch belt.
That's one. Yeah, important. That's one thing to take note too. Like I don't mess around with the buckleless. I want to get the stick on as quick as I can and get it off as quick as I can. And in some of those squirrely trees, if you're trying to run the double and the buckleless, you know, it just takes that much more effort to get it
right, as
solid as it needs to be. But the key part of the doubles too is you stack them together and they both go on the stand in the center in the same spot. Versus I was splitting the singles and to where it wasn't that much of a thing. It was one extra step, taking it off each side, and now it's just wham bam. So that ended up being you know.
And you probably got yours customized so when you stack they just silenced and locked in place.
You know, I will say with the doubles too, diving into that. And the way I actually run my belts on there with the buckles, they actually provide a buffer on the sticks. Like, you're never anywhere near making
any
noise.
That's what I figured out. I was taking the buckles off everything all the time, and now I see where you're running them on that outer edge of the step. You alternate those, and they literally are your silencing to pull them together. So,
yeah, and like, I couldn't – my setup, I can't make noise with the doubles if I try.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not even a whole lot of tape on them anymore. It's just those little corners, and once you run those belts, it's
so a new development too. I don't know, were you running your eighters to one point or did you split them?
No, this was right actually. Yeah, so this was right around the time that you came to me and you're like, hey, should we split these out? And then I'm like, well, let's try it. And we rigged a couple bolts in there, so yeah. I did the same thing. So
that's nice.
Yeah, so now all the doubles do have the hole, right?
Yep.
So they have is that a quarter inch hole or 5/16?
Actually, I'm looking at being able to run those on the studs themselves. Getting a longer stud that you can get out of, you can adjust it for further from the tree, but would you have the ambition just no extra bolts, put it on the bolts already there, a couple lock nuts, and it's good to go. So I got my set already ready to go for next year. So
that's a huge thing too. You know, over the course of time, when you're beating down the singles, you know, and you're bending the eighter, it can get a little tight. It still, you know, has that function, but this integration of now the eighters being mounted wide on the doubles is just that's the ticket, I think.
Yep.
It's very good. So let me ask you this. field testing aside, all the products are always going to stay the same and never change again. And now you're picking your setup. You're picking your setup to go in, and you'll never change again. What do you pick?
Stick-wise
and stand. And you can add the 7.5 in there, too.
I couldn't give you an answer. I swear to God. I still think next year my plans are I'm going to hit that 0.5 early. Smaller boots, a little bit lighter weather. But you know how I am when it gets late season. I get some big Iceman boots on. I got big bibs. I'm not a big guy, but when I'm done dressing for later season, I'm taking up some space. So I'll convert over probably and be a 50-50. And the 7.5 will fit in the middle there for either or, actually.
It might be
the perfect stand.
That's interesting. Like, even this question, and it's, you know, at the base of it, talking about changing for things, that's a huge point to make is, you know, your clothes, as they're getting bigger, like that 0.5 can become smaller. It might be a little bit more of a you know, pain as you get bigger boots on. And to whereas me, like I'm usually wearing the same gear. So I don't see that as a necessary change.
One thing I noticed, I stand more now, a little bit more with the 0.5 than I ever did. And I think that's because it's just so damn comfortable to stand in that. Where you're sitting on it, where a 1.0, you're kind of out there a little bit. So it leans you more to sitting.
Yeah, I see that. I see that for sure. So what about sticks?
Sticks.
Yeah, but you dodged the question. You have to pick one stand. You can't, I'm saying, like, this is the hypothetical. You can only use one stand and one style of sticks for the rest of your days.
If I had to do it, I'd almost have to go to the 1.0 because then I could obviously use that earlier, easy, early season. But late season, I don't know if I could handle that 0.5 through the whole season.
So why not the 7.5?
That might be the, I haven't hunted on one yet, but that might be the hybrid for it.
Okay, what about sticks?
Sticks, okay, I did mostly compacts last year. I'm really starting to lean more toward doubles myself because now people haven't even heard of it yet, but we are going to develop a grommet system for that, which if you already have sticks, it's going to fit on your existing sticks you got. I'm pushing for two doubles with, now that they're wider, the eighters, a little bit longer eighters in there, and I think that's going to be my package for this year, a majority of the year.
So you're going doubles in the 1.0.
We'll be well run heaviness.
Well, I'm saying you got to pick one forever.
Okay, that's what I'm picking.
How many sticks?
I'd almost have to say I'd have to take three. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The two is going to be for the whole year. It might be.
Yeah.
It might be a bear.
All right. From there, this is kind of the same question.
Damn.
Well, but it's in a whole different entirety. So this is focusing on your pack and your gear that you're bringing. So this question was the same. What is in your pack, the key items, and does this change throughout the season? So first, what would you say, what are your staple items that are in your pack as a whitetail hunter, filming his hunts, all that?
Camera arm. I got my smartphone for filming. Small set of binocs. I used to run them big 8x56. I'm running that smaller pair now. So a pair of binocs, tape measure, just in case. I don't even carry a knife. Trim saw for sure is in there. License. I've been carrying, I'm not a big fan of those daisy chains in that. But I've always carried a belt extension, and now I carry that belt extension, and I do carry extra daisy chains in there because I can get three of them in there. And if you ever did forget your belts or your pack with your belts on it, which happened to me once, there's always a use for those. Bottom strap, you know, slap that on. So I did carry those this year. Extra hat, gloves, and then when it gets to late season, I'll start carrying like a pair of lighter pullover pants or a vest in the pack itself.
So you're not taking anything out of your normal gear. You're just essentially adding stuff as it gets colder. Like you're not.
Yeah.
Like, nothing.
I'll tell you one thing I added this year that I never did before: a bottle of water, which is, I don't know if I'm getting older now or whatever, but that's nice to have on post after your. We've all got to a stand where we worked up a sweat and we're just dripping wet by the time we got in and get settled, and it's nice to have that little bit of water. Never carried it because of the weight before, so that pack's got enough. It's got more than enough room now for me, because before I had the big full size camera and those big binoculars. That was the two main things in the pack, and now with smaller stuff and running the smaller camera, it's a lot of extra room in there. So.
Yeah, so, you know,
garment, sudden.
This is a key thing, too. You know, we get a lot of, you know, on a side tangent, a lot of people, big question is, hey, you know, I get a lot, what are you filming with on your stories, or what do you guys recommend for a guy getting into filming his hunts, or this camera, that camera? I mean, this is a pretty extensive podcast topic that we'll dive into an actual podcast on, but, dude, these smartphones nowadays, not only are they light, they got excellent zoom capabilities, and they're taking some quality video. So one of those paired up with the pocket arm is a deadly combination for, I don't think there's any, you know, and you, everybody's got a phone already for the most part. So,
right.
I mean, that combination is deadly, and it takes up no room.
The biggest thing you got to be conscious of is you need to stay off it on social media and just be filming and not be tempted.
Yeah.
I could tell you some stories this year that would,
yeah, we'll get
little funny ones.
We'll get to that. So, all right. I mean, to answer this question, you know, I gotta. First of all, I have to say that, you know, for the last couple of years, I've completely eliminated a pack altogether. Just really trying to. I set my stand up as my backpack, if you will. So, any additional gear that I'm taking that's not in my pockets, which you'll find when I list off my stuff, is really not much. I messed around a little bit with a bino harness, and I was using that to house some of my things that I take. But now, you know, if I'm taking the pocket arm, it's strapped, you know, under my seat or under my platform. You know, usually a small trim saw that's in my pocket. So I had this. I'm the type of guy that if you give him a bag, he'll fill it. You give me pockets and I'll put something in them. Like I'll find, and I love bags, just like packs in general, you know, organization, you know.
Here's the big thing between me and you. You're probably taking your stand in and out every time.
Yeah, see. So,
if I leave my setup in.
You got to be able to take
I
your
I got
pack.
My big backpack, put all my stuff in there. I can haul it in the morning. So.
And that's the one thing that's been tough for me is like in those circumstances, because there's been times where I could have benefited from that. Like, oh, I'll just leave this in and not have to mess around for 5 minutes setting this up or not have to, you know, carry this in the extra, but it is my rig. Like my tow rope is hooked to the stand. Everything is there. So it does come in and out with me. That's another reason why I want it as light and as quick to hang as possible. But, so, you know, with that being said, I think one day I had my backpack and I talked about this on a past podcast that I did with the Vortex Nation guys. And I just, you know, I looked at that in my backpack and everything that I didn't use, I looked at the last, I think it was like four hunts. And if I didn't use it, I got rid of it. Like, you know, what are you carrying that you never use? Because this is a huge thing, I believe, in efficiency, because it's just like you said, I don't know if I'd be able to go the whole 3-4 month season hanging every day, multiple times a day, morning and evening, packing in, packing out.
So what do you got in there that you need absolutely every time?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. What I take consists of a knife, some cording, or I guess some just a little bit of paracord for, like, you know, attaching a tag or a couple hair ties, a zip tie. So this is all kind of, and then an extra battery for my And this is all in a tiny little, like, vacuum sealed little sliver of a bag. Like, just these key items, like an extra GoPro battery, the tag, cordage to attach the tag, my knife, and binos is something I never really used a lot in the past. And I correlate that to now not having a powerful camera with a zoom. Before, it was always like when I carried a big camera, if I seen something out there, I'd point that camera and I'd be able to zoom in on it. Now, without that option, like, you know, using more handycam style stuff, phones, GoPros, it's, you don't have that benefit. So having a good pair of binos, and those I usually wear. Small trim saw always comes with me. Tow rope always comes with me. Let me see. And I recently started carrying a headlamp, which I never have. I don't know if my eyes are just getting worse or whatever, but coming out at night if I'm running real late.
I didn't have that light in my bag, but I have that light on my backpack. So it's always, I always got a light with me. So for,
yeah, I mean, you know, when it gets, and even your phone can die or whatever. But so being that I don't, you know, coming around to the answer to this question, being that I don't really take anything, I mean, other than my gear doesn't change. Late, as we get into late season, or as it gets colder, I'll start to take like a down layer or something, which is awesome because I can just stuff it into a sack and strap it on my seat. Hat and gloves is always key.
Extra hat and gloves. Yeah. So I have one on, I have a pair, and I have an extra in case your hands get drenched on the way out. A hat is very important for a really cold day to double up a hat. Let's say your seat's wet, you can use it as a seat cover. There's a lot of things. You ever have a stand so iced up that you can barely stand on it? You could throw a hat down on the bottom that fuses to the stand. You got some traction. It's just a million different, and the strap. How many times have you lost your tether or your connection to safety harness? You're not going up. If you got that extension, you can jerry rig something. So you don't miss a day hunt, you know, or a morning or evening. So important.
And a
trim saw. Trim saw all the time, but really never a knife.
I like to have a knife every day, even when I'm not hunting. So many times you need to cut something or need to do something, and then, you know, so I always have a knife for sure.
Do you carry a tape measure?
I don't. I got a rough, you know, I can roughly gauge it by like my fingers, and I do have that cording, so like I can pull a rough measurement if I need to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have to say that, you know, as the season changes, I don't tend to get lighter because I'm always light. Clothes is one thing. Now, I will say, though, like, as it gets colder, I'm usually wearing another layer out there, so I'm not packing in a whole lot. I do take an extra hat, but I don't take extra gloves. The hat,
I got to carry my clothes out. I cannot get out with all that on there. Just overheat.
All right, we're going to change directions a little bit. And the next question is revolving specifically around post-season scouting and shed hunting. Now, this is another topic that we'll, you know, probably dive into a little bit more in depth at a later point. But I think this question was focusing around if we're looking for sheds, and when we find said sheds, are we using that knowledge? Do we find benefit in that knowledge? There's a lot of people out there that claim to have really good success from finding sheds to like hunting a deer the next year. And I really think it only correlates. I mean, it can give you a general, I guess, idea of a home range if they're not moving a lot. But the idea that information will make you more successful early season, I don't kind of believe. I think that's late season. You know, if you're hunting that deer again late, and, you know, the food's the same and things haven't changed, like, it can help you out. But I think the big misconception...
Well, is it a deer that's been on the property the whole year and then you find the shed? Or is it...
I think the big misconception is, like, so let's take any prior knowledge out of it. I'm reading this as somebody like, hey, I went out shed hunting and I found this huge 90-inch side in this thicket. Like, is that where he's going to be next year? Is, you know...
Could be.
Exactly. So it's so hard to say.
How many big sheds have you found out here that the deer was never, you seen on a property, and the next year is never on it. It just came in and wintered
that,
and dropped this rack here.
That's where I think the misconception is. I believe, now, if you're hunting that deer all year, you never see him, and you get to then, it's later in the year, I think that information is valuable to where that deer might be the next year if he makes it at that time. If it's, you know, I mean, like you said, because that's, it's all just wintering sign. Like, you know, right. You find these
sheds for us is too late. It's after the season's over, and that deer might come in 2 weeks after the season's over. So it's
maybe a
really rough winter. It might come in early.
And that's where there's so many variables to that. So, you know,
I don't hold a lot of stock in the sheds for just that the deer made it. He's alive. And if it was when I was hunting, he's back. How many? Well, the one buck that we hunted out here 3 years in a row now, we had the sheds of him for 2 years, but he only spent 4 days on our property the prior year. And then the prior year before that, he was on a little bit longer. So he's living on somebody else's land.
Now, I look at this in two ways, 100% true. And, you know, so one bit of information, though, that we could get from that is we knew exactly where
he was coming from
and where he was entering the property and like that.
And they dropped along that travel route.
Yeah, every time. And that, in turn, gave us his entrance to the property every year. Yeah. So we knew that. It was just a matter of he never made it to us in time to, you know, be capitalized on. But so, like, there's an example of where you can use some information. But that didn't become relevant until every year, bitter cold, late.
Yeah.
You know, we couldn't use that. If some random guy had walked the property and found those sheds where they found them, he could have hunted there every day of the season the next year and never would have seen them.
Right.
You know, so.
But actually, in all reality, even though it was a couple-day window, that was the spot you'd have had to been to tie into them. So, yeah, it could, you know, plus or minus. So,
there's some stock in location. I think if you find, oh, man, it's hard to, you know.
If it's a shed from a deer you've never seen before, never been on here, obviously it's somebody else's deer that's wintering on your ground, and it's probably not going to do you a lot of good.
Yeah, you know, I think you got to think, though. Not all these people who are asking these questions to are, it might be a big piece of public ground.
Right.
And they're just trying to, you know, so a lot of these people aren't even seeing a whole lot of bucks, and they're getting out and they're wanting the shed hunt to gain knowledge. Now, I think you're better off on that shed hunt doing some postseason scouting of some travel corridors and looking at last season's sign and, you know, using that antler as just an identification that he's there.
Here's a perfect example. Northern Wisconsin, years ago, big country, the deer yard up. And there were spots in there that look like a boneyard where you find all those sheds, but those deer were coming from miles from every direction. So that wasn't a piece of the puzzle for us at all.
If anything, it maybe gave you an inkling that somewhere in the miles around there was a good shooter deer, but you can't really put any stock into that because it's, and that's what I mean about like scouting in season and everybody asks what I'm doing postseason and if I'm doing this in the summer. And it's like, yeah, I do stuff, but like really, I mean, you want to put all your stock into what you're seeing in the moment.
The day before and the day of is where you're.
Because that's really like
where you want to read that.
Is there anything you're specifically looking for, you know, when you're like postseason hiking around, while you're looking for sheds? Is there anything you're taking in that you are using for next year?
So, we talked about this before. Every year we shed hen on here, I go into areas that I've never even been before in this property. I know a deer's bedding there. He's on that mound of rocks or whatever, but now is the time of year you can actually literally go in there and walk right up to the bed that he's been in. So that's some knowledge you can get. Different travel routes by hunting. I learned two spots on this property now that the bigger bucks enter and exit the fields where there are no trails, treacherous, mountainous part that they just climb up out of like a mountain goat and end up on the field. So you learn that from years of use, but
so you found that out postseason scouting is what you're saying?
No, I went and looked at. I found that out during the season. I could see where they squirting out of there and squirting in, but so, then I went and looked at it.
Yeah, And I was going to get to that too. So to highlight what you're saying, you're advocating, you know,
go poke around anywhere you want now.
You're taking things that you probably learned this season and you're going to further investigate them because it doesn't matter now. Because,
right.
You know, it's just pretty much, it's the season's over and you're trying to connect those dots that are, you know, prove a hypothesis correct that you had earlier in the season. I mean, you can, you know, there's a lot of things you'll see. I mean, you'll see all the signs from the season. You'll see all these scrapes, all these rubs. But, I mean,
what does that mean? No.
Well, sometimes, I mean, I think that's where I think you got to take it with a grain of salt. But, like, I've found some pretty huge, like, big primary scrapes in these bottoms that I didn't know about. I found them late. I mean, they weren't obviously active late or anything like that. But just notifying or being able to take account on those, like, gave me a little bit of a guide of, hey, next season I'm going to come down here and see if this lights up in October.
Yeah.
Or just, you know, bedding areas in general, if you're covering a lot of ground on big public land areas. And, you know, I know that it's going to change with the season and where they're feeding and stuff, but, you know, a lot of these areas.
Here you couldn't use rubs as an indication because there's rubs everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you could use, maybe this is something they could look for, and we're going to cover that in our program on strictly rubs, is what I call like a community rub. Normally it's just not a lot of trails. A lot of guys will mistake them for like a rub that's reopened every year thinking it's the same buck back. But if you look at those and they're just more or less worn out instead of rubbed on, those are what I call community rubs. Those are phenomenal areas for just deer traveling through. No trails, no sign, but those are the ones you probably want to hunt during the season if you find some of those. And they're normally in spots you wouldn't be hunting because there's just not a lot of sign here. Just like I said, some of them draws, them deer are coming up through. There is no trails. There is no sign that they're being used because there's only a couple big bucks using them, and that's their travel route. So once you learn that, that's a piece of information you can take from later in the year that you could use the following year.
By identifying tracks.
Identifying that
the rub.
Yeah, that rub. Rub in the area that it's at.
So here's an example that, now this isn't postseason scouting, but example of one of those community rubs. In Kansas about 5 years ago, literally at a road crossing, there was a telephone pole. It was like a thin, like gangly looking telephone pole. Like it might not even been in use, but like it was freshened up every day. You know, this is November. I mean, bucks are cruising these hedgerows for miles, and it's just like every day you check that thing, and we tossed a camera on it, and it was just literally bucks galore. Yeah, like, you know,
bucks.
You know, and it could have been, you know, positional too, but I mean, that was a killer area to capitalize on. But there was nothing else was getting rubbed. Nothing else anywhere. So I don't know if all these bucks were just, you know, laying that scent on there, and there wasn't even a whole lot of scrapes, but,
right.
You know.
Yeah, I found a few like that in Illinois too, telephone poles that were, I think the scent of that creosote on there, and then all the other bucks are just marketed. And you know, some of them bucks aren't making those rubs on there. Some are pretty big and aggressive. But you see these little bucks go up and do the same thing. They'll rub on there, and they're just leaving their scent on and going through the motions. That's why they look more of a polished rub than they are really torn up and aggressive, because they're just basically leaving some scent behind.
Yeah, so they're not gouging or anything. Right. It's you know, I had a conversation with a buddy about this too, and he kept checking scrapes. And he's like, man, he's like, they're just not hitting these scrapes. And I'm like, oh, they're hitting those scrapes. They're just hitting the licking branch. They're not, you know, just because these scrapes aren't getting like tore up on the ground didn't mean those bucks weren't frequenting that scrape. I mean, they were.
What did you notice about this year? This was probably the most phenomenal year for scrape hunting that I've experienced in a long time.
I didn't notice anything because being out of state all of October and then not hunting any scrapes over there. And then when I got here to Iowa, it was kind of breaking loose and like deer were just running. So I didn't get to do a whole lot of scrape hunting.
It was insane.
So I think I hit it late. So when I was hunting the river bluffs in Wisconsin on some public ground there, I got on a hot scrape line. Like, I mean, I'm talking super hot, and I'm 100% convinced that I missed it by like 3 or 4 days. Like, I think it just busted loose. But there was, there were scrapes like I'd never seen. I mean, just the amount, the, so I don't know, it could have been something I just missed, mm-hmm. maybe, but.
And, you know, maybe it's because I was running cameras, but we had some mature bucks on scrapes this year that literally every day were in there working those. Even when the rut was going on and they had those in heat, were coming back and just working them bastards. So I don't know what it was, but I killed the two bucks I shot. I killed off of scrapes, one the early and one the later second round scrapes. So
So you don't have any inclination of why you thought that was?
No, I don't. That one buck that was running on the east part of our property, literally, like I said, on a daily basis, it had that area pegged off. It was a primary scrape that's there every year. But the damn deer was working that thing just about every freaking day. So, and the same with that non-typical I shot. That thing was, it was like taking candy from a baby. That thing was going from three scrapes on the property and just working those daily.
Yeah, I know those. I mean,
we'll talk about that.
Yeah,
in the show
we're going to do a scrape. We're going to do a whole scrape episode pretty soon here. And I mean that because if you key in on it, that can be deadly.
Oh god,
so many deer. I can think of.
And it's not that you're even killing them off that scrape. It's just that piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, you're using that scrape to your advantage. Some of the best hunts I've had, cleanest, easiest kills, whatever, have been utilizing those things. And yeah. So we'll get into that at a later date. Coming off those listener questions, we're going to change it up a little bit. And we've been sort of ending these episodes, or trying to at least, with success stories on how, you know, we're utilizing the day's topics. We're going to switch it up a little bit today, and we're going to share a story about one that got away. So why don't you tell me, and then I'll tell you. We'll just think of a story, think of a mess up, a screw up, or a time you didn't get the deal sealed, and what you learned from it, and what, you know, how that changed how you hunt, and if you ever then, you know, made that adjustment and then got one killed.
Not a lot of occurrences.
Make sure you
like
go
that.
Into the mic.
The big ones for me are deer that I actually ended up hitting and not getting. Those are the ones that it's like,
well,
I always,
those all got away.
I know, but those are the ones. I got my opportunity. I did everything I needed to do, and I just did not close the deal. Shot a little too far forward, a little too far back, or whatever the deal was. And these deer make it. They're tough animals, and they make it to another year or so.
Okay, so what is the mistake you're making?
I don't think I'm making a mistake. It's just that it's the point, the moment of truth. And, you know, whitetail hunting, it's not all 100%. Just because you got a 15-yard shot at a big deer, you don't always get them, so.
All right, this isn't exactly shaping up into like an epic one that got away
Let's
story.
Hear yours.
But, I can think of so many one that got away stories and fuck ups on my end that it makes my head spin. All right, I'll tell one. This is I might have told this on another podcast, but it's a good story, 100% true. I actually have it all on film, which makes it even worse, and I've never released it yet. But you know, not we're not talking a mega giant, but we're talking a good buck, right? This was the year I switched up my release. I went from the old True Flight, big, massive hand strap release,
Free Flight.
That's the year I went from that to like more of a streamline, like True Ball, like finger trigger. And I remember when I switched that, you came out one day and I was shooting my bow and you're like, oh, did you get a new release? And I'm like, yeah. And you were like, why? And I'm like, well, it's a lot more streamlined and this. And casually you were like, that thing's going to fuck you up this year. And then walked away. And I don't know if that was you planting a seed in my head. Like,
you call it mind fucking.
Yeah. That's what I figured. But anyway, so I'm like, oh no, this is good. I got this. I remember hitting it hard all of October and just like really just being a step behind. And I finally nailed it, man. I set up this fresh stand, or this virgin sit stand. I'm up there and the sun's coming up and I see these deer funneling down the ridge and it's this doe and like the, you know, it's late, it's closer to Halloween now and these does are starting to come in and there's this big, you know, probably 155-inch 8-pointer following this doe. And he's right on her ass and they're coming right down. And I'm looking at him with the binos, you know, figuring if he's a shooter or not. And I decided like, well, no, he's not big enough, but he's coming down. This is going to be a good morning. Well, they halt in the trail and they're just stopped dead and they're looking in my direction. I'm like, oh man, hopefully I didn't get a swirl of wind or something. I was in a bottom. And from behind me, I didn't realize this, but they're looking behind me and I heard a very faint snort wheeze and I'm like, oh shit, here we go. I turn my head and I see this bruiser of a 10-point, heavy, just a slammer of a deer, you know, had to be, I don't know, mid upper 60s, but just an old bastard. And he comes up and he's making his way to my tree and this 8 breaks off from the doe and starts making his way to the 10-point. And they're both closing in and they're both at like 25 coming in. And I'm like, man, that 10's getting shot. Like that, this is perfect, you know, whatever. They both bristle up and they get sideways and then they charge each other and they lock up at the base of my tree and they're going back and forth pushing. I'm in a cedar tree and they're right under the branches and it's just wicked, right? So they're going back and forth and I'm like, oh man, you know, I got my bow in my hand. I got the release on the string and all that. And then they break up. It was a short fight. They break up, the 8 runs off, tail between his legs, like, and now the 10 is standing right under the base of the tree, and, like, literally my steps are inches from his back, and he's got his eye on the doe, and he starts to slowly walk, and now he's walking out right into my shooting lane at 5 yards, like, not, maybe not even, like, he's right there, and I'm, you know, maybe 11 feet up, so I turn, I go to draw, that release wasn't clipped on the string all the way. So I pulled back just enough and then it let the string go and it was maybe just back a half inch. It was just enough to unknock the arrow. So it flicks off. And I, in slow motion, I'm watching the arrow disconnect from the string, and now it's sliding out of my QAD. It's just sliding forward, and I'm like, in slow motion, I'm watching it, and it just, and then it falls out of my bow, and then drops through the platform hole in the actual platform of the stand, and then hits the ground like 2 feet from this buck, and then he whips his head down and looks, and he's like, what the fuck? So at this point, I'm like scrambling, I'm like jittering and scrambling, trying to get another arrow, and I'm panicking. And then I make a bunch of noise, and I'm getting this arrow knocked, and that buck looks right up at me and gives me the old fuck you and runs right off. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Could have got it back with a win.
What's that?
He could have got it back.
Yeah,
on the way
out. I mean, but it was just one of those things where, like, it's just one of the many that got away, and it was, you know, and I chalked it up to, you know, I was stubborn. And I think I told you about that, and you're like, "Oh, told you shouldn't fuck with that release. You know, you should get rid of it."
In the bottoms with a new release, you had it coming.
Yeah. But, you know, now I'll tell you this though: there's never been another instance like that, and I make damn sure that I test pull that release when it's on my string or on the string loop every time.
Yeah, always do that.
I mean, and you know, back I was just wasn't thinking about it. You know, and
well, shit happens.
Yeah, so that's my that's one of my one of my stories.
There's got to be somewhere I fucked up somewhere. I'm pretty flashy up close when I close the deal, but
why don't you talk about one of those ones that you hit that got away?
Well, that big one 3 years ago that we have the shed zoo. I thought for sure it was I crushed that freaking deer. That's when I was blind hunting because of my cataract. but instead of going in behind the shoulder, it went in up a little further. Blood all over, ran off hard, crashed. Remember, we were finding little bits of blood and stuff later. That deer made it. We got the sheds to it. It made it another year. Was only on a property a couple of days. And then the third year, well, we were having dinner at your house. The thing showed up on a scrape line in October, and I thought, this deer is dead. I spent the whole day setting two different spots up for that scrape line. Was all pond. I didn't tell you about that this year, didn't I? But anyhow, I just blew that right on national podcast. But anyhow, you told me that a neighbor shot the damn deer that night. So all that setup, all that shit, I was just crushed. I'm like, you got to be kidding. The one I was after for a couple of years that evaded me, he's gone.
I do remember now when I broke that news, you were a little bit more pissed off than I thought you'd be. I'm like, what the hell, you know?
Oh, but, man. No, I literally spent some time, and that would have killed that deer. He was, and that's the one with the scrapes again, or the sheds where they were laying, you said. So he was coming. He came right up through where the one shed was found, and then on the top hill where we found the other one, that he ran that same travel corridor that third year. So, but that's a deer that was living along the line. So,
and that was a one lung shot, probably, right? Most likely, over the front lung, maybe clip the opposing.
I don't even know if it was in the lungs. I think it was more in that, just in that esophagus, brisket area or whatever. But somewhere in there, it got a hold of a lot of blood for a short time, and then it just sealed up. Big animal, big old animal. So that was a screw up, and that was because I'm gonna have to use the excuse. I mean, I literally was almost blind that year hunting. let's put it this way: if you had a pair of sunglasses on, if somebody put Vaseline over them, that's what my vision was like that year. So could have had the biggest year of my life that year.
Well,
that's a screw up.
There's your lesson. Don't hunt with cataracts. There you have it. Those are a couple of the ones that got away. We'll tell some more on the upcoming podcasts. And once again, if you have a question, if you have a topic that you want to hear, go ahead and submit those on Mobile Hunters United. We're going to start to do more strategic posts to get engaged with the members and see what everybody wants to hear. So anything you want to add?
Yeah, one thing I'm excited about, we're going to do a little series on scouting and reading sign, which
the plan is to kind of go back to the beginning and do a beginner's course, if you will. So there's a lot of things in the pipeline as far as scouting and specific scouting smart episodes. And
I forget there's a bunch of guys just picking up bulls and just starting that need information, and that's so we're gonna really dumb her down to the very basics, and you can share what you've learned, and I can show you all the holes I've stepped in along the way where you'll be more efficient, take her a little slower, and I think it'll be a good podcast. So
yeah. Okay. Until next time, thanks for listening.